Senior Focus. Welcome, everyone. I'm Anne-Marie Currie, your presenter of Senior Focus for this session. And it's a welcome back because it's a few weeks since I've been in the seat here in the studio recording. Those of you listening will know that there've been some repeat broadcasts. And that's really because I've had a spell in the hospital and I'm in recovery now and ready to get going again. It's been an interesting time because I've had time to listen to a number of other radio shows during my recuperation, and having a small transistor with a very sensitive sound system has been quite rewarding. In fact, I've learned a lot. But the thing that struck me at the moment as I prepared for this session was how important our family and our ancestors are. And we've just had Mother's Day, we've just had people gathering for family gatherings, because that hasn't been easy over the last 12 months. And these precious resources that we have amongst our family and relatives, it's just that we have been cut off from them in many ways, either because they can't fly in here or because we can't go and see them, or it's just been too difficult managing things. So I think that the opportunity to gather with family is something really precious and valuable, and it's something that I know I look forward to doing eventually when I can get across the Tasman without risk of everything blowing up in front of me. I'm not really keen on that sort of a scenario, so I'm still waiting for it to be a lot safer before I go. But I do have a family reunion planned, and it's just on hold at the moment. So thinking about changes in society, we've had quite a shocking week in our news with the stabbing in Dunedin and the Countdown supermarket. That's been quite a wake-up call in many respects for safety in the workplace, for how people conduct themselves when they're out, when there's potential for that sort of violence to become even worse. Yes, there's people who are heroes, but there's also people who are prepared in those situations. And nowadays, having a safety plan, it used to be like you'd have stuff in case you had to look after yourself in the event of an earthquake. But more than not, we're much more likely to be caught up in a traffic jam that lasts 5 hours, and you know, we need to have food and sustenance and water. We can't leave the car where it is and go off and buy something if you're in the middle of the motorway or the harbour bridge. But these sort of events are happening more often. Now, if you are caught up in any kind of hostage environment, again, it's not always safe or easy to get food or water, and yet it can help people stay calm and think and be more effective in how they help others. So it's one of the things that people are talking about who are in the emergency management field, is having a small kit of a lunch pack and a flask, some protein bars and that sort of stuff, basically on hand in a backpack when you're shopping. Of course, it has to be stuff that looks as though you haven't taken it off the shelf. So you have to be careful how you package it and what evidence you've got that you've paid for it. But having something that's pre-prepared for this kind of situation, or in your car, so that it's with you when you're travelling, or if you get out of the car, you take it with you, then you've always got something. And it might sound, but like overkill to some people, but I actually can see the real advantage. And I remember 20 years ago when we were doing health and safety in the workplace, I had a manager who insisted that we had a kit in the cupboard at work, each one for each person, like one per person, and we made it up with our own stuff that we wanted, but we had it there in case, A, we were trapped in our building, or B, in case when we went out in the car and we travelled some distance to an office in another part of the city or in another city, maybe to Whangarei or to Hamilton, that if we got caught up in a motorway incident, we actually had food on us in the car, and that wouldn't matter what other staff member we had with us, whether we had someone with diabetes, for example, or any other issues, we were prepared. And of course, nowadays you probably have gloves and mask in that kit as well. So that's just a thought that you might want to do some careful planning around your own moves and your own travelling and what you do, thinking through where you go, and instead of relying on being able to purchase things when you're out, think about taking stuff with you that's pre-prepared that will sustain you in an event, because usually an event is not lasting longer than a day. So it's not like your emergency management kit that you have at home, which is meant to last you 2 to 3 weeks in the event of a major disaster. It's a different type of thing. It's like a separate kit. So I found a shop on Queen Street with a lot of stuff that they were clearing out, very low prices, and I got a really excellent backpack, lightweight but sturdy, with lots of pockets, and that only cost me $10. So I thought this is a good start to actually putting this plan into operation. Thinking about our program today, I also wanted to talk about the vision that Auckland Transport has for the next 10 years. And that consultation, which took place mostly while I was in hospital on the brink of going there, it's sort of been something that I didn't engage with directly myself, but I did have a number of discussions with a number of seniors, and it became very evident that when I went through the 100 plus pages of the document, when I looked at the main points they were focusing on, climate change, safety, transport choices and so on, all very solid stuff, but very much from an engineering lens that they were looking through, looking at infrastructure and what changes would be needed in certain areas, but not really from a population perspective. So the fact that 1 in 4 Aucklanders are going to be over 65 from the year 2035, and quite a large group will be over 65 even at 2030. It's not a movement that's just going to appear on the horizon in 2035. It's happening now. We've got an increase already, so we've gone from 15% to 20% over the last 8 to 10 years. So we're seeing that rising graph actually accelerate. And nowhere in the document is there any recognition that of the density of older people trying to get around. How will they get to healthcare? What will happen when such a large proportion of the population can no longer drive? And as I found out when I got out of hospital, I mean, there are actually laws. After you've had certain sort of treatments, you are not allowed to drive. You don't have any insurance cover. So if you do drive, even if someone else hits you, you may be the perfect driver still, but you won't get insurance. And so I was forced to use public transport for the first 2 weeks following operations. Even after that, I didn't really feel like taking up driving again straight away, so I'm still not driving. But using public transport to do my usual activities means sometimes taking 4 buses to get into the city and 4 buses out again. And I reflected on that and I thought, well, 15 years ago, the same journey took 1 bus, it took 1 hour and 10 minutes, and I could walk to that bus in 3 minutes. Now I have to walk a K, which takes me, depending on how I feel, 10 to 15 minutes. And then I've got to repeat that at the end after doing those 8 bus journeys. And the trip in takes 2 hours, and it takes 2 hours to come back. And so, you know, that's just a reflection on the amount of dense traffic that we have now, the numbers of people travelling, the increased traffic on the roads, etc. So what will that be like in 2030 or 2035? That's what we have to consider. And this document doesn't actually offer a lot. It talks a lot, and it goes into detail about a lot of things, but it misses one of the salient points that here we will have quite a concerted group of people, a considerable number of people who won't be able to drive, or who won't be able to drive on a temporary basis. Plus, we've got people who will have visual acuity problems, not just people just out of hospital. We will have people who are losing vision, and that can happen rapidly or it can be a slow thing. But the chances of people having visual disturbances once they hit 70 and 80 is very high. So again, they might find that while they're very good drivers, their eyes are going to let them down, and they're going to fail the medical tests. So ultimately, we are not catering for getting these people onto public transport. We're not making it easy. There's not the lighting and the seating and the things that are part of infrastructure that make using public transport easy. Yes, on the main routes, there are shelters and seats and lights, and it all works reasonably well. If you're travelling on the express buses on the busways, or you're travelling on those main arterial roads like Dominion Road or Sandringham Road or Remuera Road, but if you're actually trying to get to those arterial roads, then you have to use a local bus to join the main arterial route, and that's where the system starts to get very patchy. So I found, for example, 3 times in the last week standing for a bus right on the curb, signalling the driver, but there's no light on the street, on the bus stop sign, there's no light on the shelter, and there's no street light adjacent. So the driver can't see me. And with all the best will in the world, he goes sailing past because he hasn't seen me. He's not doing anything wrong, really, because he hasn't got X-ray vision. There's no way while driving a bus at 40 or 50 k's an hour, he can actually sweep the sides of the footpath in the dark to notice whether somebody's there. And so I've had discussions with the drivers, and they agree that probably a head torch or a high-vis jacket or something might be needed. I sort of have visions of, you know, needing to run the gauntlet and try to step in front of the bus, but I don't think that's a really good idea. But, you know, I did feel a bit desperate one night. The fact is that most of these routes actually are only half-hour services. So if you miss that first bus, then you wait for the next one. You wait half an hour, and the same thing might happen all over again, and you might be left standing again. So this is the kind of thing that will put people off using public transport. These are the sorts of discussions that really need to be had at a local board level, so that feedback gets into AT and people start to look seriously at how their own area is performing. Our local representatives on boards need to really take a look at public transport. I know a lot of them use public transport during the day, but I bet you they don't use it at night. They don't know what it's like. And some of us want to go to concerts. Some of us want to go out. And driving at night is always tougher for people who are older. It's tougher on your vision. And again, some people with their local driving capacity, they have a medical certificate that allows them to drive around their neighbourhood to go shopping. They do not have permission to drive at night or on the motorway or into the city to a concert. So therefore, they've got to travel on public transport or be able to afford a taxi. And not many people, 20 k's out of the city can afford that sort of an arrangement. So For our music break today, I've chosen a New Zealand number. It's Peace in the Neighbourhood by Nathan Haynes. It's New Zealand Music Month, and Nathan is a local jazz musician who plays frequently in Auckland. He's well known in Devonport. He's played at the Vic, and I thought this would be an apt music break for us today. Thank you. Welcome back, everyone. We're talking about the changing population in Auckland and how this impacts on transport, and do we have the right kind of vision for where transport's going in the next 50 years? The next 10 years. I don't think we can think 50 years hence. That would be just a bit too difficult. But 10 years will come up very rapidly in front of us. And at that point, when one in four Aucklanders is over the age of 65, and that, don't forget, that means some will be 90, some will be even 100, their needs to get around will be really paramount. If you need to get to healthcare, it's not just emergencies to hospital where you go in an ambulance. It's how do you go to the follow-up care clinics? How do you get seen by the specialists? How do you get the physio treatment, or what other interventions might be needed in, say, a renal unit? Or we've got some very specialist units, cardio units, renal units, so on, spinal units. We've got the super clinic in Manukau, and I know a lot of people on the North Shore who have said to me, I don't know how I'm going to get to the super clinic. My daughter or son is going to have to take a day off work. And look at how that's going to impact on the productivity of their workplace. It's not a straightforward business. Yes, there is a shuttle. But if you live on the North Shore, the shuttle goes from North Shore Hospital. So first you have to get to North Shore Hospital to pick up the shuttle, which will then take you to Green Lane or then take you to the Manukau Super Clinic. Using train transport can be very effective once you're on the Central Isthmus. But again, you have to know how to coordinate, and you need to be able to use AT's journey planner because ringing up isn't always the best way to get the most intelligent response, I've found. But the train does stop close to your services in Manukau, and that's very useful. But we need to have things planned. People need to have information. They need to know where to go to get this information. It's not available in GP clinics, for example, which is usually your first place where you discover that you may be going to the Manukau Super Clinic. There's all sorts of steps in the process, and there's all sorts of people who can deliver information, but they're not equipped because the transport sector doesn't talk to the health sector or vice versa. So we need to actually strategically lift game in terms of the governance of these sectors, and these organisations need to be responsive to the population, and they need information themselves about what's happening. And so it's very surprising, you see, that Auckland Transport have this vision for the next 10 years, but it actually completely ignores the elephant in the room because they have not been advised, or they haven't listened, or they haven't had the right channels working to inform them that Auckland Council is committed to becoming an age-friendly city. And its top three priorities happen to be communication, transport, and housing. And those three were the top needs that were brought up from community-wide consultation that took place across the city very extensively right throughout last year, and involved over 3,000 seniors. And I think they spoke clearly with a very determined voice about what their needs are and all of the things that could be done to make public transport more accessible, more user-friendly for seniors, and prepare the way for this future that we're going to face. All of the ideas were there. So AT's already got its plan. It doesn't need to worry. All it needs to do is communicate better in-house within the Auckland Council family, and that's all we expected. So it's a bit shocking, really, that the gap is so huge. Climate change is well discussed It's a very big wave change coming, but seniors are part of that. Now, are they going to switch to electric cars? Not unless there's some incentive financially to help them do that, because 50% live only on National Super. And again, they still may not be able to technically drive those cars. So it's a moot point whether that will be their best way forwards. In other words, we all have to learn, once we hit 70, we all have to learn to think about using other modes of transport other than driving ourselves, because we can't be sure for how long we're going to be able to do that self-driving. And we need to know the bus service. We need to know how to use the bus service, the most efficient way to do so in our neighbourhood. And I find people out on the street quite often bewildered, not sure whether they're at the right bus stop and which connection they should be trying to get to go to a certain place. And I've often helped a lot of people. But then I've struck the situation where the bus stop shifts and there's inadequate signage on the old bus stop. There's no clear indication of where to go to get to the new bus stop. And that's particularly the case with the NX Express buses that go on the busway across the Harbour Bridge. They've been shifting two blocks away from their old home at the bottom of Queen Street to the bottom of Lower Albert Street. And the poor Auckland Transport ambassador was this pink vest, signalling that he was the helper at large, came up to me and greeted me warmly and wanted to help. And I said, well, where's the bus stop moved? And he didn't know. So he set out carrying my bag on an adventure where we both went to try and discover where the bus was. And it just amused me that Auckland Transport is prepared to invest in ambassadors and pay them to be on the street, but haven't equipped them with the actual information they need to do a good job. That's a kind of gap-filling situation that it's not governance stuff, it's not what you expect in the strategic plan, but it's sort of indicative of the very ad hoc way things tend to happen. So a trial comes in to rearrange things in Queen Street, and then that trial gets prolonged, and then people get angsty about the impact of what they see as a loss of pedestrian foot traffic. So then they want to be able to bring cars back into the picture and do away with cycle lanes, and before you know it, you've got a big court case happening and there's a battle on. But this is not really the way to make progress forward. We actually need to have a vision of where the city's going, how do you move most of the people most efficiently most of the time. And that's the sort of question we need to ask. And then we need to step back from that and look at what are the workable solutions. I think this question is going to evolve a little bit further, because I think the gaps in the strategy are quite large. I've picked on the one for seniors, but there are gaps that other people have identified, which I'm not going to talk about because I'm not an expert on those. But I would say that Auckland Transport held a hearing this week where people who felt left out of the conversation could go along and present their ideas. And I think that there will be further discussion happening at the local board level. There will be groups that will continue to dialogue with Auckland Council as a whole, because they're dissatisfied with the way things are going with Auckland Transport. So watch the space, and if you have an opportunity to put your ideas forward, do so. And don't forget that being age-friendly is terribly important as a city, because as the tourists come back, we get measured against other age-friendly cities around the world. And when I've travelled overseas, I have found that those cities, Auckland, Melbourne, Tokyo, Vancouver, the ones that are really neat to enjoy, they are age-friendly, and we want to be like them. Thank you for listening and being with us, and we look forward to having you with us again next week. Bye for now. Get together with Senior Focus next Sunday at 5:25 p.m. on Planet FM 104.6 or listen online at any time at planetaudio.org.nz/Senior Focus. And do note, Senior Focus is one word.